like television studio.
Well, welcome to the to our class, to Professor Taylor, and also the associate universities that are part of the TBFF Faith and Globalization Project, who are participating in this exchange via live streaming. I'm the co-instructor of this Religion and Globalization course with Dean Ellen Aitken. My name is Dan Seary. We're delighted to have Professor Taylor with us for this conversation. Professor Taylor is Professor Emeritus of McGill University, and Professor Taylor began his undergraduate work at McGill, and then as a Rhodes Scholar continued his studies at the University of Oxford and completed his doctorate under the supervision of Isaiah Berlin and G.E.M. Anscombe. He has held the Oxford University's prestigious Cicilli Chair in Social and Political Theory and was Professor of Law and Philosophy at Northwestern University for several years after his retirement from McGill. Professor Taylor has made major contributions to Canadian political life, both in his role as one of Canada's major public intellectuals and as an active member of the New Democratic Party. In 2007, he and Gerard Bouchard were appointed to head a one-year Quebec's Commission of Inquiry into Reasonable Accommodation for Minority Cultures, a commission which had international attention. Among Professor Taylor's many books include his major study on Hegel, 1975, Sources of the Self, The Making of Modern Identity, 1989, The Malaise of Modernity, Multiculturalism, Examining the Politics of Recognition, Catholic Modernity, Varieties of Religion Today, and more recently, A Secular Age. Dr. Taylor has delivered a number of renowned lecture series, including the Gifford Lectures and, in Canada, the Massey Lectures, and is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards, including Companion to the Order of Canada, the Templeton Prize, the Quixote Prize, and the list goes on. Charles Taylor's contributions to political philosophy, the problem of modernity, secularity, and pluralism have earned him recognition as one of the leading philosophers of our time. And we are honored that you could join us today for this exchange on religion, globalization, and human rights.
Thanks.
So we'd like to begin today's class with asking you a few questions that we've come up with, a mixture of sort of your background and for the reading we had to do today for class. And our first question is about this idea of an overlapping consensus that you introduced at the beginning of the reading we had to do for today. So we were wondering, besides sort of the immoral acts that are quite agreed upon on the international scale, such as genocide, torture, murder, etc., how will this idea of an overlapping consensus work when dealing with more contentious issues? Mm-hmm. And how much further is this overlapping consensus willing to go?
Yeah. Well, you see, I think it can go as far as we can take it, and it's not easy because there are big, big differences. The idea comes, though, from not the international, which this is meant for, but the national scene, where there are lots of societies, including ours, which up to a point we could say, we have a very solid agreement on basic human rights, on equality, on non-discrimination, on democracy as our form of life, with some disagreements of what these things mean. But basically, we have that kind of agreement. But we just don't have, and will never have, agreement on the deeper reasons why you agree, or you agree, and I agree, and he agrees, and she agrees, and so on. We have very different, we have some people who have very deep religious faith, and their the idea of the right to life is they would talk something about humans are made in the image of God, and then there are people who are Kantians who don't believe in God necessarily, and they talk about the dignity of the rational agent, and so on, and so on. So we have to live in a world where, in our societies, where we have this substantive agreement on the basic laws and so on, but different reasons, and we can't try to impose one set of reasons. Now, play that out on the international scene. If we want to have an international order, and we're far from that now, where people can agree on certain basic things. So, I mean, like, for instance, these interventions, military interventions for humanitarian reasons, which you see happening and so on. Well, if we're going to have that kind of agreement, it'll have to be of the same kind. It can't be because one philosophy is being imposed. And there's a lot of mistrust in the world today about the Charter of Rights or the Universal Declaration, where some people are saying, well, this is really Western, it's really imposed. It's interesting because the attempt in the 1940s in the UN was to not to make it that. It was to have substantive input from others. And, of course, we in McGill think the whole thing was done by John Humphrey and therefore is a McGill creation. That's not entirely untrue, but nevertheless, there was this kind of input. But still, you found various people, for instance, in East Asia, Lee Kuan Yew and so on, saying this is something which is basically Western individualist and so on. So we need to have a further attempt to get people on board, and particularly when you come to very contentious issues like male-female equality and so on, it's going to be a real problem. But that's got to be our goal if we're going to live in the world together in some kind of civilized fashion. Have I talked too long?
That actually, interestingly enough, connects to our next question, which is about gender equality. So you state that before we can reach a consensus on gender equality, we need to reach some sort of sympathetic understanding of one another, male or female. That connection between male and females. What do you mean by sympathetic understanding in gender?
I think you need a sympathetic understanding of the reasons people have. See, we can't demand, we in this civilization, we can't demand that people in other civilizations have exactly the same understanding of male-female equality, for instance. So we have to have that kind of sympathetic understanding of their different reasons, because the reasons will be different. Now, if you look at the Muslim world, which is where people are all excited about the absence of that, there are these substantive feminist movements, I mean, not just by women, but others, Abdurrahia Naim and so on, which are finding their own reasons within the Quranic tradition for this standard, right? And they won't be, for instance, as focused on the idea of kind of individual self-autonomy and so on, which is very much the Western framework in which we put these things. You know, women have as much a right to make their decisions or to go for this career as anyone else. It's focused very much. It's framed by this idea of what human life is about, is each one of us takes their own path and their own autonomy. So you could find that there was agreement on some of these standards, but for a very different set of reasons. And I try to give an example, a Buddhist example of the right to life and so on. We can maybe come back to that. But that's an example of how you end up signing the same document and really meaning it, you know. But if you ask for the background reasoning, it's going to be very, very different. And we need to have that kind of openness to the difference of, as it were, justifications as against feeling, I think, which a lot of Westerners do, let's face it. They feel we not only have the right Charter of Rights, but we have all the right philosophical reasons for it. If people don't buy the whole package, then we got to bring them up to speed, maybe invade them, and give them a constitution. So, and we've got to get over that. That's a hangover from an earlier epoch, which is just impossible.
I just sort of had a follow-up question to this. And did you think that accepting sort of this different reasonings behind why we accept an international consensus, do you think, we sort of thought that there might be a possibility that this might actually limit progress towards gender equality? Do you think that might come into it a bit? Or do you think that it could work out for you?
Well, I mean, this is a political question, but I think it's a very good political question. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is no. Why? Well, because we're not going to make real progress towards gender equality, for instance, in some of the societies now where it's most, absent, mm-hmm. without changing very, very deeply the hearts and minds of those people. There's no way that can be imposed on tribal areas in Pakistan and so on, and that they're trying to do that now and it's not going to work. I mean, there's no way that can be imposed on them. The way we do inside our
Western democracies where, on the basis of a substantial consensus, we do, you know, just impose some of these standards on people that find them very bad, unlivable, or just too bad. But there's just no way, even if this were a good idea ethically, it's an impossible idea politically. We don't have that kind of government. So that's why the importance of this kind of consensus is so great. There's no other route to getting over some of the really terrible breaches of the male-female equality, including things like, you know, the honor killing and so on. There's no way of getting over that without creating this consensus. There's a very interesting book by Tony Appia, The Honor Code. I don't know if you've read this, where he talks about the dynamic, international dynamic, which can occur where you get a kind of reciprocal shaming or reciprocal challenge to change. And he gives a particular case of foot mining in China, how that was changed in China by the reaction of the West and or the rest of the world. And something of the same could happen in the field of some of the more terrible practices like honor killing, provided, of course, you try to create a consensus and don't make the terrible mistake that every time I open the television I hear being made, right, where people say that's an Islamic practice. Mm-hmm. It's not an Islamic practice in two ways. I mean, there are non-Islamic societies that practice it traditionally, and it's not Quranically in any way underwritten, right? So, but if you say Islamic practice, you're setting us up for a huge alienation between the Islamic world and ourselves, which will get in the way of this kind of consensus. So we have to be clever about this. But get to your point. There is no faster way of making life livable for those women than making that, getting this conviction change there.
Okay. Great. I think that sort of answers our question about gender equality. So we wanted, you spoke a lot about Asian religions and cultural practices in the article and what sort of the West and the individualist culture can gain from that. So we sort of saw that with European expansion and U.S. power in the past, the focus on Christian values really dominated the international discourse on human rights. But now that there's an economic rise in the East, do you think that we will see an increase in the influence of Asian cultural and religious perspectives on the international human rights doctrine?
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly in some sense Asian. I mean, you know, the present Chinese government, or in what way are they vehicling Asian? There's a lot of call it Confucian, but their input's going to be greater. Whatever they're pushing, it's going to be greater, and they may not be as interested in coming to agreement on some of these things. We're going to have to live with that, and that may be very, very difficult. I mean, for instance, they just don't seem to have any recognition of something like the right of self-determination of different peoples. It's just off their screen, or they claim it's off their screen. And that's a very, very important part of the up-to-now international consensus. So we're moving into a new epoch in which the last vestiges of colonialism and Western domination are disappearing, and we have to recreate a consensus in this new epoch.
And sort of to go off of that point, I was wondering why it is that sort of in this now day and age, a lot of people in the intellectual environment use Buddhist doctrines, like you did in the article, to explain ways of life and ways of living that have strong applicability in the West. And I think that, why do you think that is? I feel like that's sort of a new phenomenon. Why do you think that has been more strongly implemented in the West as sort of a framework of how to live without even connecting really to the fact that it is a Buddhist doctrine itself and, you know, the fact that it can be separated in that distinction?
I think that's part of the dynamic of the last 200, whatever it is, years. The dynamic of Western domination, of a pushback against Western domination in societies. But at the same time, you always find that there's a certain double judgment or ambivalence here. There are certain things, that are quite good in the Western world. And maybe we should take on board. I mean, the famous quip of Gandhi, right? What do you think, Mr. Gandhi, of Western civilization? That would be a good idea, he said. But what he meant by that is something like, if we lived up to what are our basic values, which plainly from the point of view of India under the Raj was not happening, right? So there is there a kind of, you know, backhanded endorsement of certain of the things that have grown up in the West, including individual freedom and equality and so on. So the attempt has been to resituate, re-embed these in a certain sense. And that means looking at the one's own tradition in different eyes, right? So you get a Buddhist political tradition, which is in the Theravada countries, you know, mainly dominated by the image of the Dharma Raja, of the king. You know, Ashoka is the figure that somehow in history and memory is the one they're talking about. And Ashoka is, of course, a great king and a great human being and a great humanist. But this is not in a democratic context, right? So they begin to rethink this. And you have groups of, they call themselves engaged Buddhists, who've been working in Sri Lanka and Thailand and so on, to work this out. So you get this new intellectual creation arising out of that encounter, which in a sense is not in anybody's tradition. But any more than, you know, the best things in the West are in age-old tradition. We have to make big, big changes in order to develop a society in which democracy, you know, a civilization in which democracy is basic. So it's the same kind of adaptation, of change, but it's sparked off by this encounter.
So we wanted to bring it a little closer to home and draw upon your background in Quebec. And Quebec obviously has a history of strong divisions due to both religion and language. And how do you foresee religion sort of turning around and helping to form this collective identity in Quebec in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at the moment we have this tremendous reaction in Quebec against the kind of Catholicism we had roughly up to 1960, right? And there's a whole generation that I think is very mad, very angry, a little bit ambivalent. Right? This I learned from the commission. I mean, in other words, they're very angry at the clergy and what they were told to do and so on. But, you know, for 200 years, Catholicism was part of the identity here. You don't just throw that off overnight. So you get the extraordinary phenomenon. You know, we recommended, in the name of the neutrality of the state, over the speaker's chair in the Assemblée Nationale is a huge crucifix, which actually was put up by Maurice Duplessis in 1936. It's not hasn't been there since the, you know, since the beginning of time of the Council of Trent. Nothing. And why Duplessis did that, you know, you can, well, I won't go into too deeply to the senior side of this. But anyway, the National Assembly, the day we produced our report, voted unanimously to keep that up. So why is this in a society where there's a lot of people say, on veut une laïcité, vraiment fox, et puis on veut plus d'argent? What's going on? Well, it's this profound ambivalence. So what has to happen is people have to come down from that. And I respect people sort of my age and a bit younger who, some of them, I think, they're quite unreasonable on religion because they're very, you know, it's not your blessing. They were really badly wounded by this. We have to come down from that and begin to understand each other. And here, I think, the various faith communities are way ahead of others because we have begun in the post, I mean, the Catholic case, post Vatican II, but in the general, in the world, we have begun to talk to each other. We have begun to exchange. I don't mean just politenesses, which are better than brickbats, but, you know, we won't attack you, you won't attack us. But, I mean, real exchanges are going on, where people are trying to understand, Christians trying to understand Buddhists trying to understand Jews, etc. And I think we have a certain longueur d'avance. I mean, we have a certain, you know, advance on a lot of other people in our society in this very important task. We aren't going to have a cohesive Quebec society unless there's much more, this is sympathetic understanding again, much more sympathetic understanding between different, be atheists and believers of different kinds than there is now. Because now there reign, unfortunately, stereotypes and fears and so on. And that's what is, you know, threatening to tear us apart.
And how do you think this will how do you think this will be implemented in Quebec's culture? I think that this is something, an idea that, you know, what avenue do you think we need to take to implement this sympathetic understanding of various religions? Is it, you know, is it start at the root, education, or is there other avenues to...
Yeah, but it's very hard to find the, you know, it's a nice program. Because, I mean, this is what it depends on, and then you're going to ask me how to bring this about, and I don't really know. Depends on lots of people having lots of friends, close acquaintances, and so on, with whom they've, you know, been side by side, and right, and that gets rid of it, gradually dissolves the stereotypes and so on, and makes this possible. Now, how to bring that about? Well, it's coming about in certain of our schools in Montreal. My grandchildren are in school, and they're, you know, adolescent, and they're with Muslims and others, and they just, you know, they said to me when they were watching the commission, they said, you know, what wild stuff is going on there? The crazy people are making all these remarks. To them, that was mad. That's wonderful, but that's too easy. I mean, how many schools are there where there are all these people together? The second measure, however, is something we're trying in the Quebec education system, which is this course on ethics and the different religions, which is having very difficult birth because it's looked askance at by many parents, some of them very, very anti-Greek Catholic, and some of them totally atheists. Religion in the school, don't get it. But it also has to have very, very sensitive and well-trained teachers, and it takes a while for that. So it may have trouble getting off the ground, but it would, I think, do a tremendous amount at that level, at least to get rid of the grosser stereotypes. But now, thirdly, it takes just a lot more contact. And so we've made a number of proposals in the commission. I mean, for instance, there can be school exchanges. Now people think of, well, let's have a school exchange with France or Germany. You know, the kids go there for a couple of weeks and the German and French kids come here. Well, what about you did that between a Montreal school and a Rimouski school, or a, you know, Montreal school and a Lanaudière school, and so on. So there are all kinds of projects of that kind, which could increase the degree of contact and meeting. And we've got to hope that it'll happen by itself and people work side by side with people. But here's where I trail off into incoherence. I mean, there are just so many small-scale things that you can do and that can't be that easily engineered by government. You know. But that's the direction we have to go in to produce this kind of Quebec.
Mm-hmm. Well, this sort of, so you're really focusing on education and contact, but there's also the federal government right now is they're proposing to establish an office of religious freedom in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Do you think this will help, or do you really think something else has to happen first? What are sort of your thoughts about this initiative by the government?
Well, I have to admit, I have profound difficulties with this government. We shouldn't go into that. I mean, I don't entirely trust their motivation, right? But it's not at all a bad idea in general. Right. But it the second thing I would say, though, it isn't an answer to the question we're asking here. I mean, that will mean that Canada will intervene or make statements or et cetera internationally about the persecution of this group by that group in, you know, you name it, Egypt and some Pakistan, etc. But it won't do anything to make the relations on the ground here, let's say in Montreal or in Quebec, different. So it's really, you know, whatever you think of that, and I think in principle it's a good idea, I'm just sort of worried about it. Isn't an answer to our question. We have to do it in our internal politics now.
And sort of to conclude our final question, we wanted to focus on very relevant issues. So at the moment, with the Arab Spring, many Middle Eastern countries are sort of trying to create a rise in Islamic democratic parties. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be some sort of a fear in the West or some sort of anxiety against this. However, if we look at Western history, Western politics have been dominated by Christian democratic parties. So I guess, is it possible that this contestation against Islam is some sort of Islamophobia, and what do we need to do in the West to deal with these negative connotations of Islam?
Well, I think that there are, you know, real problems, but there is also an evolution in course. I mean, if we talked about this 20 years ago, would have, everyone have said, no evolution at all, the Muslim Brothers or their equivalent. I don't know. But then we have the Turkish reorientation of Islamist Party, basically very, very clearly democratic and secularist in the sense of wanting to be even-handed. And then we get now Tunisia's very, very exciting development in this regard. The game, the Muslim Brotherhood there, has taken a complete turnaround in saying we don't want to impose the Sharia, we want to have a democratic society. And the big questions are going to be Libya, of course, and above all, Egypt. It's very hard. There is an evolution going on. There are younger members of the Muslim Brotherhood that don't buy the older ideas. But the old leadership is limping along. I mean, just a couple of months ago, they still said we can't have an Egypt where either a Christian or a woman can be president. That 60% of the people are ruled out of the presidential elections, you know, before you start. And now they've kind of not taken that back. But not talking about it as much. So it's going to be a long slog. Okay, stand back from this and think what we have to do. What we have to do is we have to strengthen the forces that are moving in that direction. And that means recognizing them, having a relationship with them, helping them to the extent that we can. And here's where the kind of blind Islamophobia is our greatest enemy. See, because once you put all Muslims, or all Muslims that want to practice their religion, in the same enemy category, then you're doing the work of the extremists, right, who want nothing better than to mobilize everybody behind them. And the big mistake made by the Turkish military, which was to treat all Muslim parties, all Islamist parties, as being dangerous and so on, which fortunately we've got beyond, that's the kind of mistake we could easily make if we let the ambient Islamophobia, which is based on incredible ignorance, have its head. So one of the most important things we need to do, I think, in our societies in the West, in Canada, in Quebec, and elsewhere, is fight this blind, ignorant Islamophobia.
In order to fight this sort of this strong ignorance, is it really that the issue then is really just about a power change and a power shift between the West and East, and sort of due to history we can see in Islam the way they approach power is in our, you know, ignorant Western perspective is a very direct, almost violent approach. Is that maybe what we're more afraid of in terms of these Islamic democratic parties, and it's that we don't see the it's sort of just this idea that we don't really truly understand the details of what it is to be Muslim.
I mean, if people talk about essentialism is kind of a bad thing, and I think in many ways it is. Islamophobia is based on a kind of essentialism. So the idea that Islam essentially supports that kind of violent policy, and of course it doesn't. What's going on is not the clash of civilizations. The most important clashes are within civilizations, right? And there's this big fight going on, what it means to be Muslim, what it means to be a Muslim Democrat, what it means to relate to the rest of the world as a Muslim. So there isn't a single answer. We're right to be afraid of the violent party, and we should do everything we can to disempower the violent party and empower the others. But that we can do precisely if we do not put them all in the same category. And we don't talk about Islam essentially is against democracy, or Islam essentially can't deal with religious pluralism and so on, which is really nonsense. I mean, people are looking at certain examples. They're not looking at Indonesia, they're not looking at Bangladesh, they're not looking at West Africa, they're not looking at Senegal, they're not looking. It's people, like when people say Westerners are all racist. Well, we had our innings being racist for a long time, but it just isn't true that we are all racist. And if somebody goes on saying that and then wants to be our friends, it's not going to be very easy to bring about, right? So exactly the same thing here.
So that sort of concludes the questions that we got out of the article and based on your history, and we wanted to open up the floor to both some of the Yale students that are on our live stream and to everyone here. So if you have a question, just raise your hand and I'll come with you to the microphone so that they can record the question. Yes.
Very good. My name is Megan, and I'm actually reading a question from one of the Yale students. And they ask, in the article we read for today, you say, it is a thought, in spite of the difference in philosophy, this universalization of an exigent standard, which human rights practice as its at its best involves, was recognized as a valid move and reacted within a different cultural, philosophical, and religious world. The hope for a world consensus is that this kind of move will be made repeatedly. Do you think that there is anything that members of a culture, philosophy, or religion can do to induce others into making this move within their own traditions? Or would it be more fruitful to be self-reflective and seek to understand the other instead?
Well, I don't think one excludes the other. I think they're both complementary. You see, because we learn from all kinds of exchange. And actually, let's take the following kind of exchange. You are somebody from Western society, and you're in Sri Lanka or Thailand, you're talking to a Buddhist, and you're saying, well, why do you see your politics this way and that way and so on? And that person is in the process of thinking out this kind of we would say aggiornamento in Catholic Italian, so this kind of bringing up to date. And you can help in that kind of dialogue, right? But on the other hand, you wouldn't be able to engage in that kind of dialogue unless you'd already learned quite a bit about that society, right? So I think these are two complementary moves. Getting this kind of sympathetic understanding and then engaging in discussion with those people. And both of us are going to evolve out of that kind of discussion, we always do. But you have to get a minimum degree. You have to be able to start exchanging with a certain amount of understanding before you can really do that.
There's another question from Yale here, and that is, how can consensus be created without coercion? Is it possible to create the environment to incubate such a consensus, or must one wait for them to arise, seemingly at random? Are there other sites where the international human community could come to unforced consensuses? If an unforced consensus could arise surrounding human rights, what would be the next most likely target?
Yeah, well, that's a lot of questions there. I mean, but the answer is, I'm afraid, the more complicated answer that the questioner is suggesting, which is really like the answer to the question about Quebec and how we can move this forward, mutual understanding forward in Quebec. And the answer is in a whole lot of different ways. And all sorts of completely, seemingly trivial and insignificant meetings, trivial in terms of world history, you know, between me and someone else, you and someone else from another culture, can make a very big difference over time, right? So that's a kind of scattershot answer to that question. It isn't a clear answer. It's an endless answer. But where would the next gains be? That's very hard to say, but certainly perhaps the most neuralgic, you know, the most difficult field is this field of gender relations and making possible some kind of evolution of our common views about that. I think that's a really urgent case. And, of course, this is made urgent but also hopeful in the following context. There also is big international migration. I mean, we're living in a world totally different from, anyway, the models we had of the world made up of nation states, let's say 50 years ago, where they're each sort of encapsulated, and they have a few people from outside, but these people rapidly assimilate or don't dare not assimilate, and they lose their contact with their home country. We're now living in a world in which there's very many quite different kinds of migration. I mean, think of migration of people from South Asia to the Gulf States and so on, which don't involve cutting off the contact with the home society. Involve maybe people even going back, certainly sending a lot of money back and having a lot of contact with. And in more traditional immigrant societies like ourselves or the United States here, where you have people now who are still very much in contact with Brazil or whatever, wherever they come from. So in this kind of world, you have quite different opportunities and quite different sites of this kind of exchange, which can have a really powerful influence. I mean, take the case of Brazilians in the United States. They have they're interchanging with the culture, they're into the politics, and they're also interchanging with people back home and some of them visiting and so on, and that is changing the U.S.-Brazil relationship, which in a way was kind of below the radar because we don't think of that. It's not just the governments talking to each other, but it's this massive movement, and it can go sour if there's a great deal of alienation and resentment on the part of an immigrant group, which is what's produced in certain European countries, or it can be very, very positive.
Did we have any questions from the classroom? During the commission itself in 2007 and so on, there was a lot of grassroots resistance within Quebec, not only from the right, but also from the left.
Mm-hmm.
And other commissions were set up in parallel. What do you think that effect had on the commission itself, and what has come out of it?
Affecting the commission, I mean, we were sometimes very worried and appalled by some of the things that were said. But I don't think it affected, in the end, the report. I think that, you know, the direction we have to go in was fairly clear from the beginning. And, of course, it really, the whole way you're going to cast it will change in the discussion. But I think the basic lines were there. So let's look at this important point you're making of the convergence of the left and the right. Right? And here's one of the classic cases of the, you know, the issues that arise within, if you like, certain, in this case, ideological communities. I mean, take feminism. Okay? So certain Quebec feminists thought that anybody, you know, allowing anybody to wear a hijab, let alone a burqa and so on, was absolutely out, right? So you just would never tolerate this. This was against the whole cause of feminism. And then others had really the kind of view that I've been propounding here. We've got to build a consensus across different faiths and so on. And so they said, sure, there are really real Islamic feminist movements, some of whose spokespersons wear hijab, because they think that's how it should be. And they split down the middle about this. See, because on one hand, there's a thing called a statut de la femme, conseil de la femme, statut de la femme, whose leader took very much the strong anti-line. And then there's a Fédération des Sociétés Féministes, or des Femmes du Québec, and so on, which is a broad federation of different feminist movements, which took the other view, the same view that we were taking. So I think what you're finding is that, not so much the right, if you like, but the left is split on this. And we, within the left, if I can put myself in that position, we have to fight this out. I mean, argue this out. And that's the direction. That's very important, from my point of view, to make headway there in order to have a better world in which to live tomorrow.
Anyone else in here?
Don't want to knock the
microphone. I was just wondering how secularism and religion can coexist.
Well, you see, I think that depends what you mean by secularism. So, you know, here, of course, we're using the language of laïcité, which isn't quite a translation of secularism, but they're close to each other, right? So we have these rather different notions of laïcité, which are fighting it out now, and we call them, you know, we put forward the idea, maybe a little bit of a persuasive use of words, of a laïcité ouverte, and there is another laïcité, which we would call fermée, but, you know, but that kind of laïcité thinks of secularism or laïcité as being mainly concerned with putting religion in its place. Religion is potentially a danger, and we have to circumscribe where it can, you know, where it can operate and how much it can operate in society. But to draw a line around it. The other view, which is our view, is laïcité should be seen as a formula for living together with very different outlooks, some religious, some non-religious, in a way which is fair, it's egalitarian, just democratic. So we have these basic principles of trying to maximize freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience on one hand, and equality on the other, which requires some kind of state neutrality. In that kind of case, there's not a specific problem of religion. There are problems of there being inequalities or breaches of freedom of conscience which are inflicted on certain groups and not others. But sometimes the danger comes from a very laic movement and not necessarily from a religious movement. So the imposition of very severe restrictions, for instance, on Muslim girls wearing the hijab, we see as a kind of imposition on some Quebecois by others. But the thing emanates now from an anti-religious frame. Then there are other cases where, from the religious side, there's an attempt to impose certain things on others. And we're, the laïcité ouverte is against all of these, it's trying to defend against all of these, but it's not targeting religion as the problem. Can you get through that?
I have another question from a Yale student, and they ask, could you elaborate on what you mean by the qualifier unforced in describing the desired consensus on human rights? Mm-hmm. We can all agree that an ideal consensus on human rights ought to be universally accepted rather than hegemonically imposed. It seems doubtful, though, that we can entirely remove from this discussion force and coercion in all their forms. A more difficult question is, what is the precise nature and degree of force that ought to be applied to punish violators or otherwise enforce a consensus on human rights norms? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, it's a very good question because, we have to make a distinction that I didn't make clear enough. I'm talking about an unforced consensus between majorities in different civilizations, right, that come to accept that this is going to be the right way to be. The kind of thing we have now certainly within the West, there's a consensus on certain, as I say, human rights, equality, right? But that doesn't mean that everybody agrees. This consensus is a consensus between majority outlooks in different civilizations, and it can only be, in the end, unforced, it's going to work. But obviously, these values, these rights, have to be sometimes enforced. Sometimes they're violated by people. Right? We have a world consensus, more or less, I think, that murder is wrong. But, murders occur, and people have to be apprehended and put in jail and punished and so on. So, in that sense, there's no getting away from force somewhere in the picture here. But the unforced consensus is, as it were, between the majorities in different civilizations who come to see their own civilizations, religious groups, and so on, who come to see their own tradition in terms which demand that they embrace these particular values. And therefore, we can come to agreement on the practices, even though the reasons are different. So as you said, reading the questionnaire, I'll say your use of the word non-hegemonically enforced is what I mean by unforced.
In the sexuality and gender model, we're looking at the case of polygamy, the polygamy debate that's going on in Canada, specifically in the Islamic communities and in the Mormon communities. And it seems to really come down to a tension between religious freedoms and the liberal values that we have in Canada and also the possibility of abuse. So at what point do you think, if any, politics should draw the line between religious freedom and religious practice?
Oh, yeah. Whenever you have something that is, let's start from here. Whenever you have something that's really unacceptable, a behavior that's really unacceptable, then you have to draw the line and say no. And the question is, is polygamy one of these? And I think, from my own point of view, from the standpoint of male-female equality, and this is open to such abuse and is itself in some ways an abuse, that it falls in that category. See? But again, connect up to the answer to this question here, that's a general remark about anybody trying out certain unacceptable practices, whatever their motivations. There are people that, there are various kinds of people with Nazi inclinations in our society, small minorities who want to propagate hatred and so on. They don't have a religious view here, but they do have an ideological view, and our hate legislation in Canada
forbids that, and rightly so.
Sorry, I had a question, not from Yale, from regarding Islamophobia and what the best way is to combat it here. Because I have people that I know who sort of, I suppose the best way to say it is to suffer from this illness. You know, and I think what I try and do is sort of, because these people, they tend to congregate, you know, and form communities in which they're only in dialogue with each other. And so therefore, all the things they say make sense because it's coherent with the sort of model they've constructed for themselves and the community they've constructed for themselves. And my approach thus far with this person is to try and just sort of, spend time with them and sort of try and poke little holes here and there and things like that. Because I think, like, maybe dialogue is a good way to do this sort of thing and make sure that these people don't, I mean, we don't want to demonize anything, right? Because that tends to just sort of separate things instead of bringing people together. And I guess I'm just sort of confused about the best way to go about, you know, eradicating this social illness.
I mean, if you're talking about person-to-person relations, then it's never good to say, you're saying that. Right, well. But it's always good to put forward information. I mean, the whole thing depends on appalling ignorance about, you know, basic facts that anybody in geography class should have learned, or history class. So the manière douce, I mean, you know, the nice way of acting is the right way. But I think we also need, but also without necessarily targeting terribly, we need more statements by leaders of all kinds, political and others, political, religious, opinion leaders of all kinds, you know, saying, no, this is not a way to go, this is not true, this is not what's going on in the world, let's try to understand better what's happening in these other parts of the world. We're only going to move it if we have really very strong trend among spokespeople of important movements, which in North America, well, maybe in Canada we're getting that, in Quebec to some degree. In the United States, they slipped from that in a very worrying way. I'm a bit appalled at how recent, you know, the whole fuss about the Ground Zero Mosque was so counter to what I understand as the foundation of America, of the First Amendment, that I'm really astonished at how many important Republicans piled in on that. And I really think it wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. And so that's a really bad drift, because here you have people that, by definition, as leaders, they have some kind of audience and influence people and so on, and they're playing into this incredibly ignorant ideology. So we have somehow to push back against that. I must add another word. I mean, I very much admire the mayor, Bloomberg, because he really came in very strongly on that. And that's the kind of thing we need more and more of. So there's the one-to-one level, but then there's the level of opinion leaders who have to step in on this and really be very clear.
In follow-up to his question, and you mentioned it a little bit, it kind of touched on that media plays a large role.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, maybe should you advocate a policy that any negative image the media portrays about, like, a religion that contributes to Islamophobia, they should also, like, have to show kind of a counter-image or something that supports interreligious dialogue or shows.
No, I don't think that's the best method. I mean, there's kind of quasi-censorship here. I think that's not the best method, but I'm looking for a good method. I mean, I want to distinguish, of course, real, obvious appeals to hatred and even violent action, which are covered by our hate speech. Incidentally, the Americans don't believe in that kind of thing, and that's why they had this nutcase who wanted to burn the Quran, you know, holding the whole world to a ransom. I must say, it must have been good for his ego. You know, he wakes up, the Pope's writing to him, the President of the United States is writing to him, and so on. Wow. So I'm somebody. But they should have been able to say, no, this is illegal. So there's that extreme. But then there is the bit of common or garden Islamophobia, like an important daily newspaper in Montreal, which shall remain nameless. And there, you really can't, the law is not the right instrument. It's too blunt. So there we have an extra burden. We have to create a climate in which that is pretty shameful. You know, that, you know, this is really, you know, you're behaving like, you know, ignorant, totally ignorant, you know, prejudiced people without any sense of what the world is like. We've got to create a climate in which that kind of stuff is, you get laughed out of the scene by indulging in that kind of stuff. And we may be edging towards that. I mean, other media than the company that owns that nameless newspaper are reacting against that, and maybe we can move things down.
If the media, to a certain extent at least, controls that climate, and a climate of fear, if you will, risky does sell newspapers, how do you propose to, I suppose, motivate the media outlets to work against essentially their own interests?
Yeah. Well, because there comes a point where, you know, where they can be perhaps shamed by their own equals. I mean, we're talking, and that's, for example, just pure hypothetical example, the chroniqueurs, or people who write, what do you call it, you know, regular columns, right? In the newspaper that I can't somehow name, there are some of those who say things that I find very shocking. And so there's one thing, to make it not worth the while of the company concerned, let's call them Fox North or something, to do this kind of thing. And another thing is that the people themselves who write this kind of thing, who move in circles that are more educated, can come to be really shamed by this. I'm hoping this will happen one of these days. And so that is a way in which we can alter the climate. It's very interesting to see. A good example is the cartoon crisis started in Europe by the Danes, right? And then it was taken up by, in Germany, a large paper. They reproduced them, and Charlie Hebdo, which unfortunately suffered a terrible, I mean, absolutely, totally unjustifiable attack, but the Charlie Hebdo did the same thing in France. And now here is a classic case in answer to the earlier question where the law is the wrong thing to do here. This is not, I mean, it's not a real obvious appeal to hatred and so on. But we want, there ought to be a purely informal ethos that you don't take very weak and minorities that are already being beaten up on and make obvious fun of them. You can criticize them. You can have writer, you know, editorials saying this practice and that practice are not good. But this kind of ridicule should be off the screen. I mean, just give an example. If you had in a Canadian or American newspaper a caricature about a woman politician showing her as a prostitute or something like that, people would have outcry, right? And rightly so. Right? Not because you ought to outlaw it, but because it ought to be part of the unspoken ethos of communication among citizens. You don't do that kind of thing. Now, in the English case, they had enough sense of that that nobody reproduced these these cartoons, right? And that's where we have to get to. I mean, it's a hard place to get to, and I wish I had a faster way, but that's where we have to get to.
Great. So I think that brings us to the end of our time here. So thank you very much to Yale and all the schools participating in our live stream. Thank you to you for your questions. Thanks to the professors and the TA. And obviously, finally, thank you very much for coming to speak with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So, 75 very quickly.